This is Dewey Pascal, and I'm sitting here today about to interview Mr. Daniel Preston, who is a gentleman who's been on the staff at Morehead State College for many years and a practicing musician himself and music teacher in the Fargo-Morehead community. Today's date is June 30th, 1986, and Dan, thank you for allowing me to come to your apartment here at 201 11th Street North in Fargo and interview you. The purpose of this interview is to accumulate an oral history of the arts in our community from the years 1930 to 1975. And I know that you've been active in our community in the arts for many, many years. I know there also was a time in your life, which we'll get into, when you were not a resident of Morehead and Fargo, but you've been back now for a number of years, and I think it's important that we have your contribution to this oral history project. I guess I'd like to begin, Dan, by asking you, if I may, where were you born?
I was born in a small town in Wisconsin, close to La Crosse, 16 miles east, Bangor. It was settled by the Welsh and named after Bangor, Wales.
Is that right? And how long did you live in that area?
I lived in Bangor from my birth until I went away to college in 1914.
And where did you go to college,
at,
Dan?
At Lawrence College, Appleton, Wisconsin.
I see. Okay. And then you got your degree in music, obviously, at that time at Lawrence?
Yes, at that time they issued only a certificate in music, and strangely enough, other colleges, if they were state colleges, might not accept that certificate, so whoever used it might expect to be taking postgraduate work in order to get a degree from the state in which they were teaching, which was my case here in Morehead. I began teaching at Morehead in 1919, and I had the certificate from Lawrence University, but I had to take a course in education while I was teaching.
I see.
And so I did just that and took all the methods they gave and studied English, composition, and things that were really helpful, but it was the taking of methods courses that was quite repetitive.
I'm sure. Most education courses seem to be that way sometimes, don't they? Well, then your degree at Lawrence was a four-year degree that time, but without the education background.
A general education. I had to take some academic work outside the field of music, but at my choice, and it was a supportive study rather than a broad view.
Okay. Do you recall, oh, I'm sure you do, where was your first teaching position? Did you teach in secondary school?
No, my first teaching position was at Morehead State College.
Oh, it was?
I had an unusual experience as a freshman. I wanted to be a forest ranger, and so I had to take advanced mathematics and chemistry, none of which I had any previous training in. And so when I took my first course in chemistry, in my last one, I flunked my first test so badly that a professor told me that, "Dan, you'll never make it in this class because all the rest of the class has had 4 years of high school chemistry and you haven't had any. So you better change your major." And strangely enough, I had studied violin from the time I was 9 years old at the, they were demands of my mother that I study violin. So I had good training in violin before I went to Lawrence. And naturally my thoughts turned to music when I found I couldn't be a forest ranger. And so I went to the School of Music to find out if musicians could really earn some money. And I discovered that the educational system throughout the country is then, and in the first years of the growth of music education in elementary schools and high schools. And the dean at the conservatory told me, we can't train the musicians enough. Oh yes, you'll be able to earn some money. So when I graduated, I could have my choice of three colleges, one in Kansas and one in Ohio and one in Minnesota. And I chose Moorhead because there was only one other teacher in music there besides myself, and I was the chairman, so it was not difficult to have a meeting of the faculty.
You were a two-man department at that time.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
what year was that again?
That was 1919.
1919.
The college was then a normal school.
Uh-huh.
They gave only a two-year teaching certificate.
So at the prospect of not making it as a forester, you then changed your position and went for music.
I was forced into music.
Yeah. Well, what? How far along in college had you gone before you changed your course of study?
About 2 months.
Oh. So you had practically all of it.
I flunked my first test in chemistry, and
That
was enough. That was the nuclear bomb, as far as I was concerned.
I'm sure that was quite a change to have to adjust to. When you came to Moorhead in 1920, you say, what was the city like? What was the community like?
There were no other than the main avenues, which were brick. There were no paved streets. And the iceman got his ice wagon stuck right out in front of my house.
And where did you live when you first came to Moorhead?
And, I lived near the old high school.
On 8th Street there?
On 8th Street for about a year. And then President Weld thought I should have something closer to the college. And then I was able to get up to 10th Street and 7th Avenue.
Oh yes, yes. That was the same house that you've been in for a number of years.
I raised my family.
That's
really.
What I thought,
they were born there.
Yeah, it was on 7th Avenue itself, was it not?
It was 7th. Yeah, it was.
Yeah. I remember that residence, Dan. I think I was in it a time or two.
Oh yeah.
When you were living
I'm
there.
Sure.
After you'd been in the community for a while, Dan, did you find that, let me ask you this first, how was the music department in the way of students and so on? Did you have a pretty good class of...
We had very, very few. The total enrollment of the college during those years immediately after World War II was 250 or 280. And it was a teacher training school, and so everyone had to have general education, whether it was music or arithmetic or English or whatever. So all of the students there had to take my course in elementary music.
Now this was way back in 1920.
1919.
In 1919.
That's right. And I think it was in 1923 when the college became a four-year college. And
I
not,
see.
Not
until that time,
school.
It was still a normal school. And what was the general length of study time for students at that time? How many years?
Oh, two.
Just two.
Two years.
Strictly a two-year institution.
And they got their, they graduated with a diploma.
Yeah. And then the bachelor's degree wasn't offered until...
No, not until after 1923.
Uh-huh. And that was when you were teaching, of course, and all the students had to go take a music class at that time.
Yeah.
I see. And when then did things progress to the point, Dan, where you started to have a choir and...
Had a girls' group at once.
Oh, you did?
That toured as early as 1922. and they were an excellent, very excellent group. And by that time, the men were then coming back from World War I, Dewey Gates and...
Can you remember some of those names
and,
yet?
Yes, and that family and...
Who else can you, think of any other names in particular that stand out in your mind?
I can't at the moment.
Okay, but and now you said you began to tour. Where did you tour back then?
Well, we'd go down to Wilmer and Breckenridge and
you did
that area, or up to Thiefer Falls and Argyle.
Was it common for college groups at that time to tour?
Not from here, it wasn't.
Well, I'm wondering if it were anywhere.
When they had Launch College, our mail corps toured every year.
Oh, they did.
Mm-hmm. And but they didn't have there a mixed choir of women, and they had only a women's chorus, and they did not tour. But I had a unique responsibility at Morehead State. They did start an artist chorus, and I was partially responsible for securing the artists.
I see.
And. Now and then I would make a trip to New York to get the artists for the ensuing year. And by 1927 we had enough men back in school to get a male chorus started. And so that year when I talked with the booker in New York, Saul Hurock,
I
asked him if he had any male singing groups that I could bring out so that my boys could tell what a good chorus sounded like. And he said, well, I have the Russian quartet, the Kedrov Quartet. They were all voice teachers at the National Conservatory in Russia, and then they were expelled from the country when the revolution took place.
Oh,
and they were on tour, and he said, I can send them to you. So I decided that's what we needed, and so the Russians came in 1928 for their recital, and it happened that that year I had in my boys' chorus seven boys with unusual voices, and we developed a what we called a double quartet. Bob Walls and Ed and Art Shonsby and Morris Fritz and Dwight Sherwood and Reuben Parsons. And we had such a good group that we sang all over the country, Saskatchewan, Chicago, in national meetings of such groups as the Rotary and Kiwanis. And,
now is this, Dan, may I interrupt, is this the beginning of the Amphion Chorus?
That's really the beginning of the Amphion Chorus, because when the Depression really struck in 1930, the two choirs in Fargo, two male choruses in Fargo, one was a Scandinavian chorus and the other was a community chorus.
Do you recall who conducted those?
No, I don't.
Okay.
They were disbanded.
Mm-hmm.
And a fellow by the name of Caldwell, who sang with the community chorus, came over to ask me if I would conduct a choir if they got started. If they got one together, and he said, we'll do all the work of recruiting if you will guarantee, agree to conduct the chorus. And so I said, well, I will be glad to do it, and but there will be some restrictions on their membership. They'll have to be at every rehearsal. But in return for that, I'll be in every rehearsal, and it will not cost them anything. And so I considered that I was as much a part of the community as they were, and
so, you
so
and your
I traded my knowledge of,
yeah,
in return for their services. And so we had 125 men.
And you were unsalaried, totally.
I got nothing for
right.
it.
Right, uh-huh.
Except my expenses paid when we went on tour. I said they have to agree to one concert a year, and there would be no liquor breaks in the rehearsals. And if we had get ready for a tour or for a concert, I would expect them to meet me every night in a week instead of one for about 2 weeks. And they did that, and we gave our first concert in 1931, and in 33 we sang at the World's Fair in Chicago. And really, it was the, I think it was the community interest in that group that got the other group started, the opera group and the orchestra group. They wanted me to conduct that opera, and I said, I have no opera experience at all. So they got the director was a photographer in town here.
I
can't think of what his name was.
Now, you were the first, really, the first successful, you might say, successful community
well,
group,
I
musical
think so.
Group.
The Amphion was the first.
And that was made up not just of community, but there
college kids. We had many college people and men from neighboring towns, from Glendon and Dilworth. And
drew from quite a wide area.
It was a wide area.
Yeah. And you rehearsed normally once a week, was that it?
Once a week.
And then until when
Monday
you got close
nights.
To a concert time. How many concerts a year would you perform, approximately?
Oh, after we got, after that year with the World's Fair, we would do an annual concert at Christmas time and another one in the spring. But every 2 years, we made a major tour to the East. And Chicago, Philadelphia, New York, Pittsburgh, and so on, Milwaukee. And so I'm sure that the influence of the Amphion was very great in giving Fargo and Moorhead
a name
of a cultural center, because the colleges began and becoming more active. Excuse me.
Sure.
The colleges became active in sending their groups out, the bands and choirs. But perhaps more than this, the Amphion had conducted a summer festival here and invited artists from all over the country to come and be in a workshop. I mean, the choir conductors, the band conductors, and what have you, came together for about a week or 10 days. And
was that an annual event?
No, that was just one. But we had Sigmund Spaeth from New York, the workshop coordinator. And, of course, he is famous for having been the first promoter of the barbershop, the Spebsquap.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. And
wasn't he known also as a columnist of some kind?
Yes, he was. He was a reporter on the New Yorker.
Yeah. Well, now, how many years spanned the life of the Amphion Corps? From 1930, you say?
The Amphion was very active until 1941. And it continued then until I left here in 1948. But the war seriously hampered the Amphion. When we gave a town hall concert in New York, and then a Swiss, Albert Morini, who was a worldwide promoter of artists, he heard us in New York, and he came out here to talk to our board about touring Europe, and he arranged 18 concerts in Europe for the Amphion in 1941. And we should have had two concerts in Paris under Alexander, with the sponsorship of Alexander Bullitt, who was the United States consul in Paris. But that never developed because Hitler's army was in Paris the very week we should have been there for concerts.
So you didn't get to Europe?
We never got to Europe,
oh,
no.
That's a shame.
We had a week's commitment in the city of Florence in Italy to highlight their summer music festival. And we never made it.
Would have been a glorious tour. You mentioned the Town Hall as one of the sites of your performances out east. What other famous halls have you played?
Pabst Theater, Milwaukee, Music Hall, Philadelphia, Notre Dame University, Carnegie Hall in New York, and the famous Music Center in New York. And Trenton, New Jersey.
Yeah.
We gave a concert there at the Westminster Choir School.
Oh.
And
must have been quite a thrill to.
It was. It was highly organized, uh-huh. And we sent out a man in advance of the choir 2 years ahead to arrange a tour. And then when we were. We traveled in a private train, 4 Pullman, a dining car, and a baggage car.
First class, yeah.
One of those old coal-burning engines. And on our travels, that train had right away over all the trains that might be, uh-huh. All their high-powered passenger trains,
uh-huh.
Had to get on a sidetrack to let us go by.
Well, that lended a little importance to your journey, didn't it?
No, it was really a thrill.
I'm sure it must have been. Getting back, Dan, to the Morehead Fargo community, do you think that this kind of thing could happen in any community, or was it happening in any community in those days? Do you feel this community, for example, had any special makeup that enabled you to succeed as well?
I do, because we had, there were several people. Well, for example, like Walter Wright, who was the oldest brother of the Wright families in the mortician group. He had done Chautauqua in the summer, as a traveling singer, and we had other voices who had sung in choirs. So we had maybe a dozen out of the large number.
Had a taste of show business somewhere.
Sort of the other singers leaned toward them for
support.
Mm-hmm. But they were all of them. Fortunately, their minds were wide open for growth in singing, and I had had enough training so that I was not merely telling them they did a good job, but I could tell them why they did a good job.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I could also tell them what they might do that would improve it. And all of my life I have been interested in the science aspect of vocal sounds and have done a great deal of research in that field, so that we are about ready, I think, to turn to science and voice instruction all over the country if they will only accept a few truths that now people hesitate to accept because they think their taste for sound is better than a science report of it.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And but like the age of computers and so on and advanced technology, we're just waiting now for choir directors to understand the content of overtones in a good voice and how to make them. So that they are exactly ideal. One with the other will have precisely the same set of overtones. And what is now on the horizon is a choir that blends through overtones and not just singing in tune. Because you can have a choir that won't blend, yet they're singing in tune. But that has never developed in the singing group.
Dan, you're getting ahead of me now, because I was going to ask what you had thought or were thinking, that what was possible and what to be expecting in the future. But before we do that, I'd like to return, if I may, for just a moment back to this business of the community and how you fit into it and so on. Can you tell me, at the time of your graduation from Lawrence, with your four-year degree in music, and particularly you were interested in vocal music at that time?
Oh, yes, that was my major, although violin was a heavy background.
Now, were there a lot of graduates in that training at that time?
No, very few.
So when you came to Moorhead, you were really a specialist as
such,
weren't you? And there weren't many, if any, other people with your background. What about the other colleges in town, Concordia, NDSU?
They didn't have them.
They had no vocal instructors at that time?
Of course, I say that with some hesitation, because they had voice teachers.
Okay.
But they had none with the technical background that I had.
I see.
I was a student of a man who studied with a very great French teacher. The French teacher's name was Jean Delresky. And there were not too many people with that background. He was the kind that would tell you the mouth, that's for potatoes and gravy.
I see.
That's not for resonating your voice. It's merely the bell on the horn. And so I learned a technique of vocal resonance that was not commonly taught.
Mm-hmm. And that's one of the reasons why you've been so successful.
I think so. That's when our shut that off. It's kind of a business at all.
Well, you're doing fine, Dan. Dad just now gave me a small vocal lesson, and I appreciate that. Dan, I'd like to again return, if we could, back to your early days at MSU. Can you tell me a little bit about the facilities you had? What did you have a choir room as such? Did they give you an office?
We had a choir room and some practice rooms for voice lessons and piano and violin.
There were instrumental lessons being offered too?
Oh, yes.
Who was your colleague that shared the department?
Well,
with
I...
Was that Christofferson?
No, Eleanor Nisham was... she taught piano, but the one who was part of the staff was Maud Wink.
Oh, she was there when you came?
Oh, and I hired her.
Oh, I see. I see. You hired Maud.
Yeah.
Okay.
The beginning teacher of elementary music was Florence Bullard and she only stayed until, she was there until about 1927 or 8, and then I hired Maud Wink.
And she, Maud succeeded this other gal?
Yeah.
I see. Now, what about in the way of equipment?
We had very limited. We had two pianos for practice, two rooms for the students to practice in. Mm-hmm.
What building were you in?
Weld Hall.
Yeah. And were you located then on the main floor there at that time too?
On the main floor. I was the first office to the right of the entrance stairway.
Okay. So, and what about a band program? Was there a band program at that time?
The band began when C.P. Archer... got Dr. Christensen, Arnold Christensen, to take over students that wanted to have a band. It was C.P. Archer that did all of the pushing for the band. I didn't have time to.
I see. What year would that have been about?
About 1927, somewhere in there.
Okay,
Now, Dr. Christensen was not a band man. He played violin, but he was a musician in that department.
Now, you left Morehead State in 1948.
1948,
yes. And where did you go?
I went to the University of Washington to complete the studies on my doctorate.
Was that at Pullman, or am I confused? Was that
at Seattle.
Oh, in Seattle.
Seattle, yes. And I was there. By the way, I refused to complete my doctoral because I got all of this academic studies I needed. But I would have to take voice lessons from a person who didn't know in from out in order to get my degree. So I never did really go through the ceremony of being granted a doctoral degree, although I have the academic courses required for it. But I became a dean of music at Pacific University in Oregon the fall of 1949.
In Oregon?
For 14 years.
And you taught in Oregon for 14 years, beginning at when? Do you remember the date?
Fall of 1949.
Fall of 49, and you were there for?
I came back here in 63.
Okay, now then, when did you go? I know you were in, that's Pacific University, wasn't it?
Yeah, Pacific University, that's right.
Okay, yeah. And you were in a position similar to the one that you had at Morehead State?
Yes, that was a college of music. It was part of a university setup,
system.
Not a department.
Uh-huh.
And I was the dean of the department, but I was the administrative officer. Tells it better than being a dean.
Oh, I see.
Some of the deans were not exactly administrative officers.
I see. But you did teach as you were there.
Oh, yes. I taught voice and conducting.
Uh-huh. Did you have the choirs there, too?
Yes, I had a very excellent choir and a male chorus of 16 voices. Did a lot of traveling.
You did? Uh-huh. And then you stayed there until 1968, you
63.
Said?
63. Yeah, my wife passed away in 62. And then I taught in two different parts of the country then. That last year I was there, I not only taught 3 days at Pacific, but 2 days at Ellensburg, Washington. Central College of Education there. I commuted over to teach there.
And what drew you then back to Morehead?
I had, before I left Morehead, I had been conductor of the choir at Gethsemane Cathedral. And then they got a new bishop who was interested in boy choirs.
And this was in Fargo now you're talking
about? In Fargo, yeah. His name was Emery. And I can't think what his name was now. He was the head of the bishop's office who knew about my work with the Amphion and with the boys' choir at Morehead State. I had a choir over there of boys' voices, too.
Now, when was that?
That was during the last 5 years I was there.
In 48,
47,
so on. I see.
At the boys' choir with the elementary school.
Oh.
Lohman was the director of the elementary school then.
I see.
And this...
Well, this was the campus school.
The campus school.
Model school, as it's called.
And because I had worked with boys' voices, then the Bishop Emery wanted me to help the churches throughout the Episcopal Diocese of North Dakota to become acquainted with the development of young singers, especially boys' voices, because the boys' choirs were commonly heard in Episcopal cathedrals.
And, sure.
And that's what he was interested in.
He was interested in preserving that technique.
So I was a vocal consultant for the state of North Dakota Episcopal Diocese and also the choir master for the cathedral. And it remained that way just for 1 year only because Bishop Emery was killed in a train accident, a train and car collision. So he was supervising my program statewide instruction, only 1 year. The next bishop was not interested in that, and so that program was discontinued, and I only had responsibility of the cathedral choir then from until I had a coronary in 1975.
You were at Gethsemane until 63 to 75?
75, yeah.
Uh-huh. And you've been active now doing
I'm still teaching
vocal coaching and private lessons. How many students are you working with these days now?
Oh, just four only.
I see, you've cut back considerably then. At what time back in just more recent years, Dan, how many students were you working with then?
I mean,
in
private lessons. 36.
So your day was full with private lessons.
And they came from both universities, and uh-huh. some from Concordia,
uh-huh.
some from high schools, both North and South, and uh-huh. Merritt High.
Yeah.
I had a big, big group then. Before I want to forget to tell you this. I have the distinction as of yesterday of being a great-great-grandfather.
Well, that's pretty exciting. A great-great one. Now, yeah. Is that then what? How many, and now let's go through your family quickly. I know that you have
five.
Five children, you do?
Yeah, three girls and
okay.
two boys. And all right. of them went through the campus school.
At Warren State school. Campus School.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And all of my children are grandchildren are married but one, and that's her picture right there.
Oh, yeah,
that's
beautiful girl.
Bill's the girl.
It is, huh? Is that right?
I have 22 great-grandchildren.
Wow.
Now I have a great-great-grandchild.
That's pretty exciting, Dan.
Yeah.
Have you seen that one yet?
No, that was just born yesterday.
Oh, just yesterday, I see. Okay. Dan, you've been around a number of years now, of course, and been in education for a great number of years, and you've been able to, from your perspective, kind of look at education perhaps more objectively than those of us who are actually in it. I just want to ask you, from a teacher's perspective now, mm-hmm. what was the perception generally of the teaching profession as a whole as related to other professionals, professional positions? I mean, how did teachers, now this is aside from being a music teacher now,
yeah.
how did you, for example, perceive yourself in the community as, or did you have a perception of yourself in the community back, you know, when you were in the 40s, let's say, when the Amphion Chorus was going strong and so on, and you were obviously very, very successful. How did you feel your position as it related to a doctor in town or
well,
a lawyer?
I felt that I was contributing something very, very valuable to the people. It was almost a therapy because it was music, and music is a therapy. It can make you feel happy and right, or it can make you sad. It's psychological, and I felt that I was part of the community, and that's what I owed it, and that's why I trained that Amphion Chorus without any pay.
And that's a source of pride, I can tell.
That was,
yeah.
I felt that I should share that with people,
mm-hmm.
and not just say, well, if you want to learn something, you come to me. I'm a big shot.
Uh-huh.
And I had never that feeling at all.
Do you think, Dan, that approach to your work is kind of a thing of the past? Are there many people who, with that kind of a dedication, who are, in your mind, willing to put themselves out and extend themselves as you did in those years?
I can't speak for anybody else but myself, but I'm very sure that when I watch all of these strikes by teachers who are already getting more money than they need to live on than go to their death with.
Okay.
I think they got plenty.
I'm sorry I asked that question, Dan, but
yeah.
I understand what you're saying.
I would say that in front of all of them, too, because I have a strong view of what I think is wrong with our country. And
I'd like
to hear. I think is that everybody wants to have more money than they can take with them.
Okay, I think I'd go along with you, Dan. I think we're all pretty greedy.
Yeah, and the minute that we get certain workers in our community with no college training whatever that earn $30 an hour for their work, yeah, then something's out of balance. Yeah. But here's one thing, Dewey, with regard to education that I feel more strongly in favor of the older I become, and that is that beginning in the first grade, they should do nothing but learn the language and learn how to read. Because in all these years of college teaching, I think I've heard more, had more dropouts. And I was on the board there at the University of Oregon, at Pacific, that had to deal with dropouts. They dropped out of their courses because they could not read. Yeah, they would go into a mathematics class and misread the question that they were supposed to answer. They couldn't do it. And so they were flunking out, and so I think that if they were to begin and concentrate on 2 years of reading so that every second grader can read well.
Certainly one of the basic
Now this little girl here lived in a home where language was used well all the time, vocabulary was adequate, and when she was in a grade school, she could speak better English than most high school kids ever learn, because she was conditioned that way.
Surely. Well, I guess the question of education is always an ongoing debate, and always forever will be. Feel any particular special relationships with your fellow staff members back in those years, Dan? And was there a lot of camaraderie in the staff?
Not too much.
Not very much at that time.
I think it was my fault, because I was always a shy person, and I never opened my mouth in a large group. If we had very close friends, then I could tell jokes and stuff and have fun. But for example, in a class with 125 students, I would never be the one to get up and say, here, Dr. So-and-so, can you explain this to me? I was, I never was an aggressive socializer.
Well, I just have a couple other questions, Dan. I'd like to return, if I can, a little bit to, as you perceive the future in music and music education, and specifically, I guess, in vocal music, and how do you feel? You talked earlier about there will be a growing reliance upon scientific information to develop pedagogical techniques, yeah, of choral education. How do you perceive that to come about?
It will not come about until one or more conductors realize that voice is a controllable thing. It isn't something God gave you. He gave you the skeleton and the machinery to make sounds with, but only infants do the thing correctly in the beginning, and their little tongues are right up against the back of their mouth. The uvula is shutting the mouth off, so the baby goes, and that's what we have to put into our singing groups that is not there in the least now. Mm-hmm. Not even a little bit.
And you
feel they sing with their mouth, the thing that is delaying this an awful lot, the development of it, is the popular concept of those that enjoy rock and roll. 20,000, 50,000 people assembled in an area to hear a lousy rock and roll band. And I don't know what they learned from it. I can't even, and you can't either, I don't think.
How do you feel science, Dan, is going to assist education?
Well, they'll have to give it a try first. If they will try it once, under a carefully planned program.
Do you know of any such program now being offered?
There's none, and I'm the one who wants to start one.
I see.
That's why I created this brochure.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. I'm going to send it to a bunch of colleges and high schools and churches. See if I can't find only one. If I get just one choir, I can show to him in 1 year of direction that he has been so missing the boat with mouth resonance that he will never resort to mouth resonance again once he learns how to use the mask of his face and the upper lip. Now don't misunderstand me. There are a lot of good private voice teachers that get some students who are even sharper than they are for feeling the right physical adjustment in the skull and the waist and the lungs. And they develop some very great singers, but there are very few of them now. There are fewer and fewer singers of that kind coming to the Met. The best thing I've heard in 20 years, I heard three times.
Dan, to bring us to a close here, I guess I just wanted to say thank you so very much for your cooperation in this project.
This has been a real pleasure for me, Dewey. I enjoy these times when we can get together and talk and exchange ideas.
Well, I'm sure that the information and the material that you brought forward today is going to be interesting to a lot of people.
Needs it so badly, and I'm telling you, when any choir once finds out how to support their sound and get a unison of overtones, you'll hear the body of an orchestra.
Yeah. Well, I know that you still feel that you have a big mission in life yet, Dan, and
I
sure
feel that, and I think that's what I'm keeping alive.
I wish
I'm 90 years old.
You very, very, very much success in achieving it. I think, however, your life has already produced a myriad of successes, which is most enviable
I have learned this, Dewey, that however well you teach, the learning is done by another individual. And the learning is 90% of the thing. If the learner is careful and analytical so that he's sure he knows the right thing, then he comes out and he makes you proud of him. But there are attitudes toward learning that are so careless that they could take you with a dozen years of 12 different teachers and not learn a damn thing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it takes, of course, the spark of a teacher to turn a learner on.
It does. The teacher has to know what you're driving at.
Yeah.
And he used to know it thoroughly. But if the student cannot discern what's going on so they can ask an intelligent question if necessary, then the best teacher on earth can't get him going.
Yeah, I agree. Thank you again, Dan. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
I hope we can meet on an eating basis one day and have lunch together or something.
That'll be fun. I'd like that. Thank you.